Hello, and welcome to this edition of To the Contrary on PBS. I am host Bonnie Urbe. And with me to discuss a very tough issue is Professor Diana Greene Foster of UCSF. She was the principal investigator of a study, a long-term study, of 1,000 women who were either granted abortions or denied abortions, and she studied the different economic impacts and the personal health and well-being impacts of being denied or being able to secure a woman's right to choose. Welcome, Dr. Foster. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me, Bonnie.
First of all, you're the principal investigator on this study. What are your credentials to do that, if you could please tell the audience? And secondly, why?
So I'm a professor at in the Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences Department at UCSF. I'm a demographer by training, which means that I'm an expert in statistics having to do with birth and death and migration, which really means that you can study anything interesting to human life with that knowledge of statistics. So I have a PhD from Princeton, and I've been doing many studies over the past several decades on women's attitudes towards contraception and access to abortion. And one day in my department, the medical director of the abortion facility said to me, "I wonder what happens to the people we turn away." And it was news to me that abortion facilities regularly turn people away. But where she was voicing her concern for her patients or people that she couldn't help, I immediately saw that that's the population we need to follow if we want to understand the impact of abortion on women's lives. So there have been studies of women having abortions, but women having abortions compared to women having wanted pregnancies isn't an accurate comparison. And so if you want to say, well, a woman who's pregnant and doesn't want to be, what are her options? Her options are to have an abortion or to carry the pregnancy to term and have a baby. And so it was a chance to follow both routes and see what happened.
All right, but it also relates back to something said in a Supreme Court decision by a former justice, Anthony Kennedy. Please tell me about tell me that story, how that evolved and why it prompted you
Yes.
to do this study.
Yeah, so the idea that abortion hurts women has resonated through our culture and as a slogan for anti-abortion activists. And that message has made it to state legislators who pass restrictions that try and protect women from making that decision. And it made it all the way up to the Supreme Court, as you said. Justice Kennedy used it, the idea that women would come to regret having an abortion and that depression and loss of self-esteem would follow. And he prefaced this sentence with the idea that there were no reliable data. And that was 2007 Supreme Court case. And it was really time for some reliable data. And it happened that year is when we were piloting the Turnaway study, testing whether women would agree to participate and whether we could follow them over time. So it's been an open question about whether abortion hurts women. And this is a study to help actually answer the question.
You said, you know, there wasn't enough information out there, and your survey just came out this summer. And so in the middle of, you know, the COVID epidemic, has it reached enough people? Do you think, have you had enough publicity? Have you been on TV and interviewed and in the newspapers, whatever?
So that's a really important question, whether the message of the Turnaway study is getting out there. We have been publishing in the scientific literature for the last 5 or so years. And so we have 50 academic papers in the scientific literature. So we have reached scientists. And here the chance of the book is to reach voters, to reach policymakers, people who may not be up on the science literature. We had spent so much time worrying about the consequences of abortion and not thinking about the consequences of denying people a wanted abortion.
Okay, so and that's a perfect jumping off point to ask, your findings were what?
So first, to the question, does abortion hurt women? We find no long-term differences in mental health symptoms and diagnoses between women who receive and women who are denied abortions. And it's not that both groups are doing so terribly. In fact, both groups improve over time. So there isn't a long-term mental health harm from being denied an abortion or receiving an abortion, though women who are denied abortions have worse mental health at the very beginning. But the two groups do diverge dramatically, and all of the ways in which their experiences differ are easily predicted when you ask women, why do you want to have an abortion? All of the concerns that they raise are experienced by the women who are denied abortions. So, for example, women say, I can't afford to have a baby, or I can't afford to have another baby. And we see that women who are denied abortions are more likely to be poor, are more likely to live in houses where there isn't enough money to pay for basic living expenses. They say, my relationship isn't good enough with the man involved in the pregnancy to take care of the child together. And we see that regardless of whether the woman received or was denied the abortion, those relationships dissolve. And then one other example, although I could give you all the reasons women give abortions and how their experiences are borne out, women say that they want to take care of the children they already have. So 60% of women who have abortions are already mothers. And we see that when we ask women about the well-being of their existing children, we see ways in which those existing children do worse when their mom is denied an abortion compared to when their mom receives one.
So, okay, but let me go back to a point you made a minute or two ago. You said long-term, and was it physically or emotionally or financially? There was no difference between the two groups.
In terms of mental health over 5 years, there was no difference. In terms of socioeconomic outcomes, there was a difference, and it lasted for 5 years. In terms of physical health outcomes, we found that consistent with the medical literature, carrying a pregnancy all the way to term and delivering a child is associated with greater physical health risks. And we actually see worse physical health over time for women who are denied abortions than women who are able to get their abortion.
How much worse?
It's the saddest findings in the entire study are that two women died after delivering. They died of pregnancy-related causes, and so it's as bad as it can possibly be, obviously, for those two women. Most women obviously didn't die of giving birth, but giving birth is associated with a lot of physical health risks. And we tend to discount those risks because women willingly choose to become pregnant and give birth when they want a baby. But all of those risks, asking women to subject themselves to all of those risks when they aren't wanting a baby is not to be taken lightly. And it's part of the reason why I don't think that adoption is an easy solution to the problem of unwanted pregnancies.
But the other problem with adoption. Because I want to talk about all those aspects. But first, two women died. May I ask, were they both of color? Because when you said that, a bulb went off. There were studies out a couple of years ago overwhelmingly showing that especially Black women were a lot more likely to die during pregnancy or after, during childbirth than white women. So I'm wondering if your findings further that point, and if so, do we have more of a socioeconomic issue here than anything else?
They were not women of color, the two women who died. About a third of the women in the entire study were African-American women, and there are health risks associated with pregnancy that are not socioeconomic, that are related to racism and access to health care. But the two groups of women, those who receive an abortion and those who were denied, were similar. Similar profile by race, ethnicity. And so that differences by race, ethnicity, and socioeconomics don't explain the physical health differences over time. Okay. But the issue that you raise is super important. It just isn't a primary findings of this study. The two women didn't happen to be women of color.
What in your findings would you want a justice in the future deciding on a Roe v. Wade derivative case that gets up to the Supreme Court to know, to persuade him or her to give women a wide latitude to choose?
Yeah, so I think that some of the important messages from this study is that women are making careful decisions when they're trying to decide what to do about an unwanted pregnancy. Women often say that it's a hard decision, but sometimes they say about half the time that it was an easy decision or straightforward. And I don't think that we should interpret that to mean that they took the decision lightly, but just that the overwhelming circumstances of their lives told them which decision was right for them. So one is to trust women's decision-making about what to do with their pregnancy. And the other is, it's so clear that the things that women were concerned about when they thought about carrying a pregnancy to term were experienced by the women who were unable to get an abortion. It gives us trust in their decision making. And it also shows you how big and important this issue is. It's not just have a baby and place it for adoption and move on. Very few women choose to place a child for adoption. Less than 1 in 10 of the women denied abortions actually decide to place the child. And it has ramifications for her future relationships, for her chance to have wanted children later, for her ability to raise her children without the threat of not having enough money to pay for food and housing.
What does it say about your findings that here in 2020, almost 50 years after Roe was handed down in the early 70s, that there's still a question of whether we should trust women? We still question whether women know what they're doing. Where does that come from?
When women make this decision, they know what is right for their families and for their own life trajectory. So that is exactly what we found. That we don't trust women is partly a consequence of not even considering the woman's perspective in this. It's like an abstract debate about the moral status of the fetus and whether women should have rights without viewing women as individuals who are making decisions, who have responsibilities, who have aspirations, who are like the women in our lives, who are like our relatives and neighbors and friends. So I think it's partly that we have abstracted this debate and politicized it, and then we fail to actually consider the real people involved. There was a great scene from a documentary by Al Jazeera where the interviewer asked Jim, I think, Bucci, who was a Ohio state representative and the author of many restrictions. She asked him why a woman would want to have an abortion, and his face, he's like totally stumped, looking up words for help, you know, and he finally says, oh, I don't know, I'm not a woman, which, you know, he's the author of restrictions on abortion. It's something he should have considered. And this study is, I think, unique in having quantitative data to show that this issue affects a lot of people and that there are hard outcomes involved. It's not an abstract debate. It's an issue that affects real people.
Do you think those findings will affect opponents of the right to choose?
I think you can be morally opposed to abortion and still learn a lot from this study. It would tell you that it's not morally acceptable to ban abortion and ignore all the negative consequences that fall from that, that there need to be many stronger supports for poor women and children in this country before it is moral to ban people from having abortions. And that the idea that adoption is gonna be easy is also not based in the evidence. When we followed women over time, the few women who'd placed the child for adoption were more likely to experience regret that they hadn't gotten the abortion than women who decided to parent. So it's not easy, and there is something to learn. It doesn't tell you whether abortion is right or wrong. It doesn't tell you when does life begin, but it tells you the consequences of receiving an abortion and of being denied.
I do remember over, you know, having followed this issue for many, many decades now, I do remember there was a time 20, 30 years ago when anti-abortion conservatives were putting out that if you had an abortion, you were more likely to come down with breast cancer. And that, of course, turned out, and the media coverage of their supposed finding in the first place was much greater than the media coverage of the fact that they were wrong. You look in your survey to the future medical impact of abortion. What were your findings there?
Yeah, so the medical literature, the data on abortion complications is robust. It didn't need this one study. But I confirm what we see in the medical literature, which is that abortion is associated with very low complication rates. The serious complications all came from the potentially life-threatening complications all were experienced by the women who carried the pregnancy to term. And, were much more likely to be experienced by women who carried the pregnancy to term.
So you're saying abortion is safer than having a baby?
Yeah, the medical literature shows that birth is associated with 14 times higher risk of death than abortion. And we don't have this wasn't the study to generate those statistics, but our findings are consistent with that.
How relevant today medically is abortion? I ask that, and I mean surgical abortion, as opposed to pharmaceutical abortion, if you will. Obviously, when Roe v. Wade was handed down, there was no RU486 or Plan B. So, and many, many millennial women and younger women are going online, getting prescriptions for and using those medications that you don't need to go see a doctor for in most instances. So, abortion itself, surgical abortion, how necessary is it today?
First of all, one quick correction. Plan B is not an abortifacient. It's a emergency contraception. It doesn't prevent pregnancy if the woman's already ovulated. So if she's pregnant, it won't interrupt the pregnancy. But RU486 or medication abortion, we say, and that's mifepristone and misoprostol, not Plan B. Surgical abortion is still important. There is a increase in medication abortion over time, we've experienced in this country a dramatic increase where people who getting abortions in clinics are actually increasingly likely to be getting pills and not having a procedure done. But for later abortions, it's still a procedure and not a medication.
But later, at least the pro-choice movement has always said that late-term abortions, third trimester abortions, are kind of a red herring because they're such a minute percentage of the abortions that take place. And it usually has to do with a fetus that will die in the womb anyway, a fetus that has incredible medical challenges, that sort of thing. So isn't that still, even if you take second trimester abortions into account, aren't they still a way lower than medical abortions are?
There has been an increase in medication abortion over time. Medication abortion is tend to be used around up until around 11 weeks, I think, but I'm not a physician or a nurse, so we can all go Google
so first
this later.
But first trimester.
Yeah, talking. Not even till the end of the first trimester. So if an early abortion, now medication abortion is an option. Lots of restrictions have the state-imposed restrictions on abortion have the effect of slowing women down and making it less likely that she can even choose to have a medication abortion. We've had hundreds of restrictions in the last decade imposed by states that have the effect of closing clinics, making women travel farther, and slowing them down. It's also quite possible that those laws prevent many women from getting an abortion. This idea that you can't prevent abortions, you can only prevent safe abortions, is not true. The Turnaway study wouldn't exist if women were always able somehow to magically get the abortions they seek.
How many, this may be beyond your knowledge, but let me ask it anyway. How many women now live in states? I think I've heard the use of numbers such as 17 or 18 states where abortion isn't provided anyway, where there are no OB-GYNs who offer abortions in that state, and that they either have to wait for doctors to fly in from other states, or they, the women, have to go to other states. And many of them are the western states, huge states, where traveling much farther distances than they do on the East Coast, for example, just to obtain an abortion, if they can get the doctor to do it.
Yeah, I don't think there are many states where there are no doctors or no clinics. There are several states that only have one abortion facility. And certainly there is a lot of interstate travel because of abortion restrictions, because women are trying to go to the closest one, and the closest one might be across a state border. Abortion access is sort of a nightmare in America. And I have to say, even in the Northeast, where there are maybe more providers, it isn't easy for everyone. Imagine being a young woman without a driver's license, without a car, without a lot of cash, where you need your parents' permission, and you don't live with your parents. You know, you can imagine that abortion is not easy, can be very, very difficult to access, even under the best circumstances.
Now, using your findings, how would you like policymakers, members of Congress, judges on courts of appeals, et cetera, to look at your report and use your report if they do?
So there was a 2016 Supreme Court case, Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt, and it banned one type of abortion restriction in Texas. And one of the beautiful things from that ruling, it said that the restriction was unconstitutional. But one of the consequences of that decision was to say that abortion restrictions should be based in evidence. And it's not enough for a state legislator to say, hey, this would improve safety. They actually had to show that that the restriction would have a net effect of improving women's health or well-being. And if we stick with that Whole Women's Health decision, the Turnaway study is extremely important, because it shows that when women are denied abortions and when abortion is too difficult to access, it has serious ramifications on her economic well-being, her children's economic well-being, and her life trajectory, her chance of setting aspirational goals and achieving them, her chance of having a full-time job, her chance of having a good, high-quality romantic relationship later, and her chance of having an intended pregnancy later. So this is, it is, if we are weighing the evidence, we would throw out the Hyde Amendment, which restricts funding for low-income women's abortions. That is a law that is unfair and creates lots of unintended negative consequences. So the Hyde Amendment
has been the law of the United States since for at least 5, maybe 6 decades.
Yeah, I'd have to look up the exact history, but it has a very negative effect for sure now. And we would re-examine how we try and regulate access to both contraception and abortion, to have the laws be more in line with what is known about safety and less for political grandstanding.
All right. Well, Dr. Diana Green Foster, thank you so much for this. It's going to be a difficult climb, I'm sure, getting your report out there to the public, but it's a fascinating report, and it's something that policymakers should at least take a look at or know that is out there for their use. Thank you so much for your time and fascinating work on this study. That's it for this edition of To the Contrary. I'm Bonnie Urbay. Please join us during the week. Follow us on social media at To the Contrary and www.pbs.org/To the Contrary. And whether you agree or think to the contrary, please join us next time.
Funding for To the Contrary provided by the E. Rhodes and Leona B. Carpenter Foundation, the Colcom Foundation, and the Charles A. Frioff Foundation. For a transcript or to see an online version of this episode of To the Contrary, please visit our PBS website at pbs.org/To the Contrary.
Be more. PBS.